am deeply honored by this invitation, which takes me to Cologne after 20 years, more or less. I must confess then, when I was asked to give a lecture here at the Institute, I thought, oh, Germany, what better setting for a meditation on the Weberian concept of formal rationality? Then I was reminded of the old saying that you should never intentionally bore your audience, and this is why I choose a different topic. So I'm going to bore you unintentionally. Well, when Queen Elizabeth II visited the London School of Economics in November 2008 and asked, in the middle of the credit crunch, and asked her innocent question of how come nobody could foresee it, it took 8 months and a seminar organized at the British Academy for some of the country's most influential economists to respond. In summary, Your Majesty, they concluded in their letter of July 2009, the failure to foresee the timing, extent, and severity of the crisis and to head it off, while it had many causes, was principally a failure of the collective imagination of many bright people, in both in this country and internationally, to understand the risks of the system as a whole. End of quote. A few weeks later, another missive reached Buckingham Palace. It was signed by 10 heterodox economists, admittedly expressing a minority view. They pointed out that the mainstream, I quote, overlooks the part that many leading economists have had in turning economics into a discipline that is detached from the real world and in promoting unrealistic assumptions that have helped to sustain an uncritical view of how markets operate, end quote. The typical omission of psychology, philosophy, and economic history from the theorists' academic training was emphasized. However, they didn't explain what particular advantage the study of history should bring about, apart from a reference to the awareness of historical precedents. Similarly, Dolores Kidelsky, Keynes' passionate biographer, called for the reform of economic education. It was clear to him that the master was back and ready to beat his never-minded successors. He elaborated a bit more on the role of history and other Geisteswissenschaften, arguing that the study would alter the economist's perception of economics as a natural rather than a moral science. The topic I'm going to talk about, the relationship between history and policy, is problematic indeed, and historians would be tempted to say that there should not be such a link, because the past doesn't repeat itself, and history has no lessons to teach, not to mention the risks and dangers of presentism. Well, in the selection of the questions, the historian is always influenced to some degree by the context in which he lives and by the problems of his time. The extraordinary growth of economic history in the 1930s was due to a large extent to the great economic turmoil and social distress those years. Another golden age for the discipline, but also for the Western economists, economies in this case, was the post-war period, when experiences of economic development needed to be put into perspective. This kind of dynamics can actually be observed in all historical subfields. The present fortunes of gender history or environmental history, just to take a couple of examples, would have been unthinkable 50 or 40 years ago. There is nothing wrong in acknowledging the influence exerted by the present on the questions. What's important is not let the present drive our search for the answers, which would mean that we no longer respect the otherness of the past. But this is an ever-present threat, whatever the point of departure of historical investigation. History doesn't help to avoid past mistakes, nor to make the right decisions on the basis of past experience, as if it was a learning by doing exercise. I don't believe very much in the lessons from the Great Depression literary genre, which has known an impressive revival in recent years. History cannot be useful if one expects from it such trivial and mechanistic prescriptions. The Great Depression and the so-called Great Recession, although comparable in intensity, are two very different phenomena generated by different causes. The crash of 1929 was the iceberg tip of an overproduction crisis, of the latest and most vehement symptom of the market saturation that was affecting the American economy in the twilight of the Roaring Twenties. On the contrary, the origins of the 2008-2009 crisis are to be sought entirely in the financial sector, in the speculative motives of rentier, the excessive power of investment banks, and the poor system, the very poor system of rules, allowing such things as the subprime bubble to happen. Nevertheless, an analysis of the two phenomena shows the existence of common mechanisms at work. And these mechanisms have to do with the inherent instability of capitalism, something on which both Keynes and Schumpeter would agree. But analogies stop at this very general level precisely when we abstract from the plane of individual historical situation to consider the economic and social system an old-fashioned Marxist would call it the mode of production of which they are part. This is where the study of the past meets social theory. On the opposite pole, there is a view that the past is worth studying for its own sake. This proposition can be subscribed only partially. It can, as long as it serves to discourage those who wish to draw some immediate practical utility from the study of history. But such a statement fails to recognize the deeper motivations that lead the humankind to question the past. If the past was dead, that is, if it did no longer relate to us in any way, there would be no reason to deal with it, except perhaps for antiquarianism. On the contrary, we clearly keep dealing with the past because we feel that no matter how distant and different it is not alien to us. This doesn't apply just to the historian, but also to the lay person, as history, even its academic practice, is always tied to memory. Rather than thinking of history as the science of the past, we may look at it in another way, as the science of man in time. This concise definition, which we owe to Mark Bloch, means that the object of history is society, not the individual. It is therefore a social science, one approaching its subject matter from a very special angle, that of time. In other words, it is a science of change. History then deals with the evolution of societies across time. Yet the sense of time, that is to say, historical sense, is by no means universal. The need to maintain public memory, being common to all societies, can be regarded as universal. But there are ways to construct shared memories without taking time into account. The ancient Greeks had no historical sense, not in the current meaning of the term. And this remains surprisingly true from the archaic period down to the Roman conquest. After all, they had no historians, and those who liked Thucydides wrote about contemporary history didn't really consider themselves as such. The Greek collective memory lay in the timeless myth. We find similar examples in many other ancient non-European civilizations in the Near East, as well as in South and Central Asia. The need to entrust the collective memory to history rather than to the myth does not seem to depend so much on having a cyclical or linear conception of time, the latter being common to most written cultures, but rather on how fast time is perceived as passing. In a society that doesn't experience dramatic changes, there is no need to make sense of these changes. It's not by chance that studies of economic history tend to flourish in developing countries, as is happening today in China and Latin America. Traditional societies are normally not interested in their economic past, and perhaps have more pressing concerns, while postmodern societies are keen to forget it. Prior to the British Industrial Revolution, we find no account that we may call economic history, at least in the Western world. And one reason for this is that nothing unusual was happening in the economic sphere, creating a sense of discontinuity. The other reason is the superior status traditionally attached to political events, another belief that was starting to be challenged at that time. Adam Smith, David Ricardo, Thomas Robert Malthus, and Karl Marx wrote about the great transformations that were shaping the first modern economy. Each of them captured some particular aspect. All of them, except Ricardo, who was a clever yet rather uncultivated man, also tried to understand how things had evolved. Thus, for example, Smith tells us that everything began when, I quote, "for a pair of diamond buckles, perhaps, or for something as frivolous and useless, the feudal lords exchanged the maintenance of 1,000 men for a year, and with it the weight and authority which it could give them." End of quote. This is very much a description of the early origins of capitalism. It's probably inaccurate, certainly stylized, and neither Smith nor any classical economist ever used the word capitalism. Nonetheless, they started formulating historical hypotheses. During the Enlightenment, however, the seeds of a dangerous idea were planted. Philosophers speculated about the existence of a natural order, extending to the social sphere and mirroring natural law. As the principles of natural law were inscribed in reason, their understanding could be achieved by reason alone, which means deductively. Therefore, human institutions had to be explained not in evolutionary terms, but rather as the outcome of a social contract. This entailed the negation of time. Despite some recent claim about the existence of a radical enlightenment in economics, one more concerned with social justice than moderate mainstream enlightenment, 18th and 19th century economic thought generally acknowledged the operation of natural laws in this domain and sought to protect them from the interference of politics. Such laws, like the law of diminishing returns and the iron law of wages, were assumed to be universal and eternal. This is what led Friedrich List to label the classical theory cosmopolitical economy, which to him meant intellectual utopia. True political economy had to take national and historical specificities into account. Theories of natural order developed into a weak form and a strong form, with Smith's moral philosophy lying in between. The weak formulation kept itself within the limits of economics. It argued in favor of free trade on the ground of the advantages that this would bring to the actors and to society as a whole. And this view was typical of physiocracy. Then we have the strong formulation of which Thomas Hobbes had been the father. Hobbes wrote little about markets, but the Leviathan is unquestionably the first treatise where politics is reduced to modern economic terms, and practically all human relations are contracts. He argued that men are selfish and bound together by fear. Only because of fear, they are willing to give up some of their freedom and transfer it to the state, an artificial body responsible for third-party enforcement. The decision to enter into society is an economic decision, in that it involves buying and selling rights. In this way, economic order creates political order. Late 19th century scientism helped turn economics into a natural science, or a sort of social physics, or at least it fostered this illusion. The phase of neoclassical economics lasted until the Great Depression, to be resumed after World War II. For the next 25 years, it had to coexist, both in theory and in practice, along with Keynesianism. Such great had been the shock suffered by Western economies during the interwar period, that the idea of simply putting Keynes aside, however tempting for some, was out of the question. But as soon as confidence was restored, a chain of events was set off. Supply-side macroeconomic instability in the 70s offered an argument against state intervention, which was said to be ineffective. The Chicago Revolution led to a paradigm shift, and the Rational Choice Program redefined economics as a general theory of action. The slowdown of growth and accumulation of public debt brought conservative governments to power in the UK, the US, and West Germany. Moreover, the decline and fall of the Soviet Union strengthened the pride of this right-wing establishment. In the very same year that Francis Fukuyama proclaimed the end of history, it was 1989, the Third World was bound to the Washington Consensus. The age of neoliberalism had reached its peak. The most distinctive feature of neoliberalism vis-a-vis classical liberalism is its ambition to transform society. Exchange no longer occupies center stage. As Michel Foucault put it in The Birth of Biopolitics, the problem of neoliberalism is rather how the overall exercise of political power can be modeled on the principles of a market economy, to discover how far and to what extent the formal principles of a market economy can index a general art of government, end of quote. Neoliberal policies aim at imposing competition as the basic rule of social interaction. This explains the growing interest in low-end politics on the part of mainstream economists, as reflected in the creation of hybrid academic fields. The economic analysis of law is now 40 years old. The new institutional economics, established later in the 70s, has gradually evolved into a theory of the state. Political economics, not to be confused with political economy, gained momentum in the 90s. It considers political systems and constitutions from the standpoint of efficiency and suggests ways to set the rules of the game that may promote social and cultural change. Today, this neoliberal social engineering project is pursued by think tanks such as the American Enterprise Institute, the Cato Institute and the Heritage Foundation, but also by university-affiliated ones, as the Stanford-based Hoover Institution and the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. The latter, for instance, gathers an interdisciplinary team of scholars, of social scientists, I would say, under the hegemonic leadership of economics. They present themselves as united in a common mission. Mercatus Research, as our name implies, what one can read on their website, is focused on how markets solve problems, not only American problems, but problems of the world, including African poverty, financial crisis, natural disasters, healthcare and social security, government spending, and last but not least, social change. Sociology, political science, law, and history are constrained within the straitjacket of the new institutional economics to confirm the prepackaged theorems of global competition and growth. Europe, too, has become a generator of neoliberal ideas, and it is owed to more than 100 think tanks, most of which grouped under the Stockholm Network established in 1997. Transatlantic associations and discussion groups have been around since long before that, ensuring cooperation between corporate lobbyists, politicians, and opinion makers. There are nuances indeed, and one could legitimately argue that the prevailing doctrine on this side of the Atlantic has rather grown out of post-war ordoliberalism. Yet such differences I would disregard because they are outweighed by two common elements. The tenet that economic order creates political order, and a passion for social engineering. In fact, if you were a social engineer, you could not imagine for your experiments a better lab than the European Union as it currently stands. Some of its inherent features make it particularly suitable. To begin with, it's a supranational polity. Supranational, not a federation of nations, which appeals to the Enlightenment utopia. Market integration and monetary unification have preceded any serious attempt at political unification. Therefore, the Eurozone finds itself in a rather odd situation. National economic policies are to a more or less large extent conditioned by the centralized monetary policy of the ECB and by decisions of the European Commission, whose officials are unelected. This is part of a wider problem known as the European Union's democratic deficit, a term coined many years ago to describe the lack of accountability of European institutions. In 2011, an unprecedented step was taken when former EU technocrats were catapulted to lead governments in Athens and Rome. Jürgen Habermas was among the first to announce this quiet coup d'etat in his penetrating essay, Zur Verfassung Europas. Italy's incumbent Prime Minister, Mario Monti, had the singular fate of being called to rescue the country from international speculation. After a long time spent on the payroll of Goldman Sachs, a remarkable junk bond producer, he's certainly a modern champion of the free trade cosmopolitanism of which Liszt wrote about. Not so much for his theoretical work, dating back to the early 70s, as for his international lobbying activities. It's interesting to note how his austerity plan and projected structural reforms were justified to the public opinion as if it was the economy, not politics, that demanded them. They were neither good nor bad, they were necessary. This rhetoric of objectification, so to speak, whereby the economy is attributed an independent and neutral existence, was promptly embraced by the leading media. And the main parties endorsed it until it was convenient to them. After all, this is the country of Machiavelli. Thus, for several months, Mr. Monti, as did like the emperor described in Andersen's tale, marched in procession under his beautiful canopy, and the chamberlains walked along behind, carrying the train that wasn't there. In February 2012, he declared to Time magazine that Italians had to be educated to the values of competition and meritocracy, and that he was committed to change their mentality. One doesn't need to be an anthropologist to realize how wishful such thinking is. Then history materialized in the form of social conflict, and the government had to face the hostility of the trade unions, the pharmacists, the teachers, the students' parents, the elderly, the unemployed, not all of whom would fit comfortably into the category of rent seeker. In the summer, the Wall Street Journal reported a more sobering statement. Mr. Monti says he's doing what he can to change Italy and Italian behavior, but he needs Parliament to approve laws. Thankfully, let me say. In his recent book, The Illusion of Free Markets, Punishment and the Myth of Natural Order, the law scholar Bernard Harcourt put forward an interesting thesis with a Foucaultian flavor. Not only the notion of liberty associated with contemporary free markets is a historical artifact, because they are as fully regulated as any previous economic order, although in a different way. Where a public rhetoric of the Nightwatchman state exists, it pushes the state's regulatory apparatus to focus almost exclusively on the repression of deviance, leading to the paradoxical alchemy of market liberalism and legal despotism. The target here is that is the law and economics approach and its influence of the on the US judicial system. But a similar paradox emerges when we consider recent developments in public choice theory. The rule of the market is pushed to such an extreme that its coexistence with democracy is questioned, and the tyranny of the majority is blamed for forcing elected rulers to pursue irrational policies. Curiously enough, one of the arguments I heard for justifying the facts of 2011 was that the technocratic governments were appointed under a state of emergency. This concept of Ausnahmezustand has an interesting intellectual history, and a tragic one, as we know. The title of Arco's book contains the word myth. Is this to be meant in a purely metaphorical sense? If we take Sir James Fraser's concept of myth literally as representation arising out of a misunderstanding of natural laws and leading to baseless policies, the rituals, that even modern faith in the natural order of markets has a mythical character. Whether mankind does still need myths in the age of disenchantment is an interesting question that is left to our humanistic colleagues to answer. Myths are harmless until they start invading the terrain of science, that is to say, when they are taught at university and enter textbooks. When assumed as models for policy making and embraced by governments and international organizations, the consequences can be serious. The devastating impact of the Chicago Boys on the Chilean economy and society in the 70s and 80s obviously represent a worst-case scenario, as it resulted from a deliberate plan of ideological transfer from a neocolonial power to a satellite country. The effects of their policies, however, are quite independent of the brutal overthrow of the Allende government and could have been equally serious if implemented under democratic rule. Historians have the duty of demystifying the myths of pseudoscience, and this makes them responsible to society. Unfortunately, this task is complicated by the fact that historians have no monopoly over the past and its uses. Paradoxically, history itself can be abused, and interpretations of the past reduced to instruments of persuasion. The resulting narratives can be categorized as pseudo-histories. Some time ago, I was interviewed by a German newspaper and asked about my opinion on Reinhardt and Rogoff's work on financial crisis, which became an issue during the recent US presidential campaign. Their argument is that high public debt has been the root of all evils over the past 8 centuries, hindering economic growth and causing recessions. Hence, an endorsement of restrictive fiscal policies as a panacea. I found this thesis bizarre, but even more so was the fact that an amateur account comparing Florentine bankrupts of the 1340s to Latin American defaults could serve to judge Barack Obama's effectiveness as a policymaker. There are clues that allow a trained eye to recognize pseudo-histories at first sight, let's say from a book jacket. Whereas history is complex, pseudo-histories typically make strong claims and propose one-size-fits-all interpretive keys. They bear such pompous titles as Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity and Poverty. This is a work by Acemoglu and Robinson attempting to demonstrate that something is wrong with the cultural systems underlying third world economies, as they fail to develop inclusive institutions protecting individual property rights and fostering entrepreneurship. Another influential contribution to this field is North Wallis and Weingast's Violence and Social Orders. Very important book. The title sounds just sinister. The subtitle, a conceptual framework for interpreting recorded human history, is more informative about the book's modest scope. Douglas North and his co-authors have been advising the World Bank for some years on the issue of institutional barriers to development. In their view, most approaches to development have been unsuccessful so far because they didn't address the problem of violence first. How can international organizations help solve this problem? Well, they should put the money in the hands of dictators. Once violence is under control, underdeveloped countries will know how to get rid of them and will eventually evolve into Western-style democracies and market economies. Oh, it's a modern stage theory. You can think of it in these terms. As you see, Hobbes strikes back, but he does so with World Bank money. It's now time to get back to our initial question of what is the purpose of history and how can it be useful in the public sphere. I'd say that history is both a search for meaning and an injection of antibodies. Sociology and history share a more realistic view of the economy as embedded in a meaningful system of social relations. This involves a common conception of rationality, institutions, and human culture. The way these have interacted over time to form the environment in which we live is not self-evident, and has to be uncovered. When the goal is to understand a living organism, which is what society is, a film is more informative than a snapshot. Such an approach may well sound familiar to you and me, but to those who are outside, and I mean the laymen, the journalists, and the politicians too, especially the politicians, It probably doesn't. They are still trapped in what I would call the clockwork view of the economy, and this makes it easier for the engineers to get in. However, something has changed after the recession. There are signs that the trust in the economic profession has diminished, and many people feel that these times of economic and social upheaval demand deeper understanding. The public opinion should be warned that economic systems are historically determined, and capitalism has evolved in time. Modern capitalism, democratic capitalism, and post-democratic capitalism have followed one another over the past three centuries. Further transformations can be expected, though it is difficult to predict in which direction. The public opinion should also be warned that the economy is a social construction, a man-built environment. It is not an iron cage constraining human action. An economic policy is never a one-way road. When people are asked to give up job security because this will foster economic growth, this claim should not go unchallenged. When politicians are advised that higher labor productivity and a weaker welfare state are needed in order for Europe to compete with China on economic growth, they should be reminded that such goal is unrealistic. Countries can industrialize only once. The economies of Western Europe took off a long time ago and are now close to what John Stuart Mill called the stationary state. Not accepting this is like not accepting aging as part of life. Like old age, the stationary state has its positive aspects. For example, it might bring about less pollution and more social justice. Keynes firmly believed in the power of ideas, but this is not the kind of battle that can be fought from a university chair. The sorcerer's apprentices were sacrificing society on the altar of utopia, deferring one substantial aspect from the madman in authority described in the general theory. Not only they are not the slaves of some defunct economist, as their masters are alive and well. The technostructure of which they are part is the expression of vested interests, and their ideology is flexible enough to accommodate such interests. The historian, as a public intellectual, is just as powerless as the child in Andersen's tale. Nevertheless, he is in the position to say that the emperor is naked. This won't stop the procession, but at least the others will know. Thank you.